Welcome to Should I Love This Comic? Hello and welcome to Should I Love This Comic. My name's Damien Drouet-Whiter and with me I've got...
Hello, my name is Irigail Drouet-Whiter and I forgot to introduce myself at the beginning.
That's fine, we'll cope, won't we? They know who we are now, don't they, darling? So really we're here today for our fifth episode, if I'm saying that. Ooh. I haven't counted in advance. I think it's our fifth episode.
Great.
Of Should I Love This Comic, where we look at a comic from my collection and decide whether or not I should love it, because I love loads of comics, but I don't always love good comics. Sometimes I love bad comics.
But we do sound effects.
We do sound effects. Are you raffling a comic about?
That's the comic.
Today we're going to be talking about Hellblazer, issue 31. Cover date July 1990, which was on sale on the 22nd of May 1990, so just a few weeks before my 16th birthday. It was written by Jamie Delano, the artist was Sean Phillips, the colourist was Tom Zuiko, I think that's how you pronounce it, the letterer was Gaspar Saladino, better known as Gaspar, the assistant editor was Tom Payer, and the editor was Karen Berger, with a cover by Kent Williams. So what I always do is I start by just going through the people who created the comic and telling you a little bit about what they did, how I view their career, what I think is great about them, what maybe I don't like, if there's things I don't like, and maybe to suggest some of their best works. So if we start with the writer, Jamie Delano. Unlike many of the creators I've featured on this podcast, Jamie Delano has produced a comparatively small body of work in comics. He first appeared writing illustrated prose stories for Marvel UK in 1983. He soon contributed to Marvel UK's comics line, writing Doctor Who and Captain Britain. In addition, he wrote a few one-offs for 2008D and a little series that was one page a week, called DR and Quinch's Problem Page, also for 2008. He's from Northampton and became involved in the town's creative scene. This brought him to the attention of Alan Moore, who encouraged him to write comics and in 1987 recommended him to editor Karen Berger to launch the Hellblazer series. Jamie was the writer for the first 40 issues of Hellblazer, so that's worth thinking we're on issue 31 here, so it's towards the end of his run, actually. And what he did was he took the Cypher, who was created in Swamp Thing, and developed him into a fully rounded, complex character. He added so much to the character that he actually gets a co-creator credit, even though he'd already existed for a couple of years before Jamie wrote him. His run is known for combining horror with contemporary British politics, and obviously contemporary to the 80s. In its first year, it features demon yuppies supporting Margaret Thatcher, which really sets the tone of what he's after. He brings in subjects like racism, homophobia, women's rights, religion, environmentalism, and many other social issues in his run. After leaving Hellblazer in 1991, he collaborated on a series called World Without End. This was a sci-fi series he did with John Higgins. Then he did Animal Man, which was principally with Steve Pugh, but some other artists helped out. And a series called Ghost Dancing with Richard Case. And a few other things. Since the early noughties, he's worked mainly as a novelist. So anything that surprising there?
No.
No, you knew nothing about him anyway.
No.
But he didn't do that many comics.
Ah.
But they were quite good.
We have spoken about him before.
Jamie Delano?
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
We're not. Okay.
Okay, so let's move on to the artist of this issue. His name is Sean Phillips. He drew his first comics in 1980. And he was actually very young when he was first drawing comics. He was only 15. And from 1980 to about 87, he was drawing comics, girls' comics for DC Thompson, the British publisher, including titles like Judy, Bunty, Diana, and Nikki, whilst continuing to study art. So while he did his A-level, his foundation, and then went to uni, I think. Upon leaving his art college, he started to work on Crisis for Fleetway, which is where I first saw him. He was producing fully painted art for the series Third World War, New Statesman, and Straight Gate. It was on Crisis that I first saw his art, and I was blown away. Painted art can sometimes be quite static and dull, but Sean always managed to get a lot of energy in his work. By 1990, he was one of the top Fleetway artists, producing stories and covers for Crisis, which is where I first saw him, and 2000 AD. And when they launched Judge Dredd, the magazine, Sean was the designer for the New Star magazine. He is brilliantly able to integrate art and design to produce phenomenal images. In 1990, he also drew his first comic for the US market. That's Hellblazer 31, which coincidentally we're reviewing today. He very soon became a key artist for DC, and in particular for their Vertigo imprint, which grew out of what we're looking at today. He very soon became a key artist for DC Comics, and particularly their Vertigo imprint. He drew short runs and graphic novels, leading to a 3-year run as artist on Hellblazer, working with writer Paul Jenkins. After Hellblazer, he drew the amazing Minx series for Vertigo. I would recommend getting that one. I love that. Written by Peter Milligan. And then he bounced around doing fill-ins and short runs, including his first superhero work, which was on Batman, Spider-Man and X-Men. From 2000 to 2001, he was the artist on a series called Wildcats for DC, which was written by Joe Casey. And then he moved over to help out on X-Men, which was also being written by Joe Casey. Now, the biggest part of his career happened in 2003 when he collaborated on the series Sleeper for DC with a writer called Ed Brubaker. That series ran to 2005, but since that series, most of his work has been working with the writer Ed Brubaker, notably on the creator-owned series Criminal, Fatale, The Fade Out, and Kill or Be Killed. Of those, I would particularly recommend The Fade Out. That was a particular favourite of mine, but they're all amazing. And since 2018, he's been doing original graphic novels with Brubaker. One of the ones that I've got is My Heroes Have Always Been Junkies. Pulp came out this year, which is doing really well. People are loving it. Back in August, so just last month as we record this, Brubaker and Phillips announced that they will be collaborating on a series of 3 graphic novels featuring a private eye called Reckless, and that will be starting in December. Sean Phillips remains one of the top illustrators in comics, able to draw any kind of story, and also produce phenomenal books where every element from publication design through to lettering is integral and appropriate. If you want to find out more about Sean's work, so obviously I've said he started in 1980, he's still working today, I would recommend checking out Twitter. And he actually did a hashtag, 40 years of comics, on Twitter, where he shared his career highlights to celebrate, and he did every year. And there's links to things you can buy. It's a really useful thing to look at. It was just fun to look at because a lot of it I didn't know. I mean, I'd recommend following him anyway because he shares art as well and it's beautiful.
Very good. So, I'm enjoying it so far.
Are you, though?
Yeah. Okay.
The letterer, Gaspar Saladino, who usually credits himself as Gaspar, first worked for DC Comics in the autumn of 1949. His first story was in a book called Romance Trail, number 5. Gaspar's lettering was immediately popular with the top artists, and guys like Alex Toth, Carmine Infantino, Gil Kane and Joe Kubert would request him as their letterer. Obviously, at the time, lettering was done on the page, so, you know, they wanted the best person to do it because they were drawing over their art. Mm. When Carmine Infantino became DC's art director in 1966, he began to give Gaspar all the key logo design jobs. And at this point, you see a change from the Art Deco-influenced logos and cover lettering by Ira Schnapp to Gaspar's more modern, energetic style. Up to the late 70s, Gaspar designed all the logos for DC Comics. He also became the page one letterer for Marvel Comics in the 70s, making the comics have a uniform look. So what they were doing, I'm going to explain this to you, darling, because yep. It sounds weird. During the 70s, Marvel did this thing where they thought what you looked at is you looked at the cover and then you opened it and just looked. Mm. And that would decide whether or not you bought a comic. Mm-hmm. So they got Gaspar to letter the first page of every comic so that it was always the best quality. And then if they had someone who wasn't as good on the rest of the book, it didn't matter as much as long as you could read it.
Ooh,
so he was doing like the titles and the logos and everything.
Mm.
So that's kind of a weird job, and nobody else has ever had that job, really. As comics moved to computer lettering in the late 90s, Gaspar got less work and stopped working regularly for DC in 2002. Fans were happy to see him return to DC in 2013, though, to letter the covers for the Batman 66 series. That's based on the old Adam West TV series. that was aiming at aping more of a Silver Age style. This led directly to Gaspar being one of the guests of honour at New York Comic Con in 2014, where he was celebrated by many current artists and letterers as the greatest comic letterer of all time. He died in August 2016 at the age of 88. But, you know, really influential, you know, worked from the 40s through to the noughties.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, that's a long time to be continually doing the same job in comics. Okay, let's go on to colourist Tom Zwicko. I may be mispronouncing his surname. I'm sorry, I've never seen it. I've never heard it said by somebody who knew how to pronounce it. He was one of the top DC colourists of the 1980s, and he's credited at Mike's Amazing Worlds, which you know I reference every issue, as with having coloured over 13,000 comic pages. Obviously, it's impossible for me to fully index what he did, you know, when someone's that prolific. But what I thought was interesting about him is when you look at what he did, particularly through the 80s, he would be doing very traditional stuff, like doing issues of Superman and, you know, that kind of thing. But he was also working on highly experimental works. And he was often the colourist that DC would get in if they were working with an experimental artist who wanted to try something different. Among his best work, really, is the stuff he did with Trevor Von Eden. He worked with him on the Green Arrow limited series and a short series called Thriller that didn't last very long. But really, you know, Von Eden was really experimenting and Zwicko worked really well with him. And he also worked on the series Nathaniel Dusk, where he was colouring from Gene Colan, who was only doing pencils, so there was no inker in between, so he had more influence. And he also coloured The Shadow with Kyle Baker, and a personal favourite of mine, Black Hawk, with Rick Burchett. He did as well, one of his best things is his 5-year run on Hellblazer, which started just a few issues, or maybe 2 issues or something, before this one, and he ended up running on there for 5 years. Going to very briefly go over the assistant editor, Tom Payer. He started his career as an editorial cartoonist for the alternative newspaper, the Syracuse New Times, in the early 80s. He ended up working at DC as an editor from 1987 to 1993, and as a writer from 1989, so obviously some overlap between being an editor and writer. He had a long run as editor of Legion of Superheroes. Sorry, no, he didn't. He had a long run as writer of Legion of Superheroes in the 90s and a particularly acclaimed run of Our Man in kind of 1999-2000 period. He's currently working as a writer and editor for Ahoy Comics, for which his series The Wrong Earth with Jamal Igel is well worth searching out. Please find that if you can. It's great. He's done lots of other editing and writing, and actually Ahoy are doing really great comics. I really should get some of them out for you. Mm. Actually get something like brand new. That would be interesting for us to focus on. But yeah, great stuff. So let's talk about Karen Berger. Her name's been mentioned before within this one, and also previously when we were talking about Dr. Fate. She'd been the boss. She was the person who trained Art Young, who was the editor of that. She began working for DC Comics in 1979 as an assistant to editor Paul Levitz. She soon began to edit her own books, starting with House of Mystery and soon expanding. She was soon doing key ones of hers from the 80s, Legion of Superheroes, Swamp Thing, Amethyst, Wonder Woman. In the mid-80s, she became DC's British liaison, as she had built a good relationship with the writer Alan Moore. She was able to bring writers... Oh, God, I can't talk. She was able to bring writers like Jamie Delano, Grant Morrison, Peter Milligan and Neil Gaiman into DC. She was bringing British writers who'd had some success in Britain over to join DC in America, working with them. The success of the comics she edited with these writers led to the establishment of the Vertigo imprint at DC in 1993. By the time she left DC in March 2013, she was the senior vice president of the company, as well as executive editor of Vertigo. She was instrumental in the expansion of adult comics at DC, and while she was leading it, Vertigo released many influential and award-winning comics. Since 2017, she's come back into comics, and she edits something called Berger Books, which is an imprint that comes out through Dark Horse. It's a very influential woman. And actually, the whole adult comics thing, which I mentioned, the first DC comic that was released that said suggested for mature readers that wasn't approved by the Comics Code Authority was an issue of Swamp Thing that she edited. Okay, and the last person I want to talk about is the cover artist, Kent Williams, because it's a different one. Now, Kent Williams has featured on this podcast before, as he did one of the pin-ups. Do you remember when we did Marvel Fanfare 40?
Mm-hmm.
And there were a series of pin-ups, and one of them was of the Submariner, and it was That was drawn by Kent Williams. He attended the Pratt Institute in New York and was one of the new breed of artists producing painted comics in the early to mid-80s, including his collaborators John J. Muth and George Pratt. His first comics appeared in Epic magazine, that was a Marvel one, and they were followed by the vampire series Blood, again an Epic Marvel thing, which was written by J.M. DeMatteis, a name you may remember from a previous issue. And he also did the Havoc and Wolverine Meltdown series, which was fantastic. That was written by Walter and Louise Simonson, and you'll have heard at least one of those names.
Mm.
After becoming known for painted work, he actually began to start working in pencil and ink, which is very different. Usually in comics, people do black and white, and if they're really successful, they get to do a bit of painting. Mm. He kind of went the other way around. And his black and white stuff was really stark. It had a painterly quality and really good at using like negative space and stuff. He's also a talented inker, and he worked in particular over Dennis Cohen on various covers. And I would point out the best thing he ever did, which I don't have a copy of myself, unfortunately. I've only seen bits and pieces online, is he inked the Prince special Alter Ego starring Prince.
Oh.
Not like the Prince, something like Prince, the Prince. You know. My name is Prince. And also there was a series called Fight for Tomorrow. I'd recommend those two. It's just been beautiful works. He also inked Sean Phillips on a preview of Minx, who we mentioned before. And he inked one of my favourite artists, Rick Leonardi, on an issue of X-Men. Nowadays, he works primarily as a fine artist and has been featured in many US galleries, particularly in New York, which obviously where he's based. So let's talk through what happens in Hellblazer 31. As I say, cover date July 1990, apparently on sale the 22nd of May 1990. The writer was Jamie Delano, artist Sean Phillips, and it's called Morning of the Magician, but spelt mourning as in grieving. We're in Liverpool and Gemma Masters can't sleep. She'd cried herself to sleep when she heard her granddad had died, and she thought it was her dream when her granddad appeared in her bedroom. She tried using the tricks her Uncle John had taught her to make nightmares go away. Grandad, what are you doing? Get some clothes on. You look silly. Go away, Grandad. I don't want you to be here. Please, Grandad, you're frightening me. You can't get in bed. It won't do any good. You're dead. It wasn't working because it wasn't a dream. Gemma runs screaming to her parents, who are convinced that it must mean her granddad did something awful to her. Gemma tries to explain that Grandad doesn't want anything bad. But whatever she says, her parents get more worried. So she apologises for frightening them and goes back to bed. Since then, Grandad had come back every night, trying to get into bed to keep warm. Surely he'd go away after the funeral. If not, her Uncle John would be there to help her. At the funeral, Gemma can see her granddad sitting on his coffin. She doesn't understand why no one else can see him. But we cut to her uncle, John Constantine. He's there, but he doesn't want to attend the funeral himself. He decides to go round the back and ask to see the cremation. So we see Gemma and her family are making their way out, and suddenly Gemma can feel the flames. She can feel the cremation. At the same time, Constantine is shocked by his father sitting up. The attendant says, "The flame jet burns straight down through the lid of the coffin. The fire shrinks up the muscles really quick and..." "Lie down, you silly bastard. Your hair's on fire." And outside, Gemma sees her granddad again. This time all burned up, and she just starts screaming. Back at the house, Gemma's hiding in a room, but she can't hide from the burnt up granddad. She can't hide from the burnt up granddad. Downstairs, John is helping his sister Cheryl clean up. They discuss Gemma. John thinks that Gemma is tough and smart and can cope with anything. He goads Cheryl about her useless husband, and they joke about their amputee father being armless. Gemma comes in. My head's too busy. I think I need some fresh air. Do you fancy a walk, Uncle John? When they go for the walk, she starts by asking about ghosts. John confirms that they're real and that they can't harm you physically, but they can damage your mind if you let them. Gemma assures him that Granddad never hurt her, but that he is there. John explains that he can't see him. I'm sorry, Gem, I can't. Doesn't mean you can't, though. It might be you he feels safest with. You liked him, didn't you? When he was alive, I did. I couldn't stand him. Always thought he resented me. I suppose that's because your mum died when you were born. Yeah, probably. I didn't realise it then, though. Just knew there was always something missing. All I could do was wind him up all the time, poor old sod. Bringing me and Cheryl up on his own must have been murder. John is feeling guilty about his father's death. He was killed by one of John's enemies. John is feeling guilty about his father's death. He was killed by one of John's enemies. He asks Gemma where his father is and goes over to talk to him. He jokes about sons killing their fathers being part of growing up, and suddenly he remembers what he'd done. He asks Gemma to wait in the cafe and then asks his dad to follow him while he explains what he did to his father. We never saw eye to eye, did we? You with all that working class pragmatism, me the arty-farty little ponce. You know, I can't remember us ever talking to each other properly. It's going to be a bit one-sided now, I'm afraid. Still, you know what they say. Confession's good for the soul, yours and mine. First off, the maniac who killed you was my enemy. I was hiding, so he took you instead. If it's any consolation, he's dead now as well. I killed him. But keep that to yourself, eh? Violent death must be a terrible shock. Pretty disorienting to the psyche, I expect. But that's not why you're still hanging around here. No, that's a much older story. Remember 1967, Summer of Love? I'd just been kicked out of school for organising an Out Demons Out chant in assembly. You went berserk. I just laughed. We were worlds apart. You wanted a son who was one of the boys, not some freak who locked himself in his room with weird music, incense, and books about magic. But you knew how to hurt me, all right. Jesus, Dad, you shouldn't have burned my books. That's what Nazis do. I'd never been so angry before. After you'd stalked off down the club, I knelt there by that smoking pile and felt something cold and fierce squirming inside me. It was called revenge. Like ideas, books are hard to burn, and I rescued a few of them, charred, spoiled things. One fell open to reveal a black gift. The weapon was in my hand. I could have chosen not to use it, but I wanted to. I felt like I was somewhere else watching myself. You made me the catapult when I was 10. I used to shoot at birds sometimes, but I could never hit anything. No coordination, you said. So, John kills next door's cat. After dark, I made it look like you. Sympathetic magic, said the words from the book, and buried it behind the dustbins. Afterwards, I went back inside and watched Doctor Who. I didn't really think anything would happen, but I felt better. A week passed. As the cat rotted in the ground, you started to get ill and old. All the fight seemed to go out of you. The balance of power shifted. My challenge was successful. I was king of the castle now. These days, when we argued, there was a flicker of fear in your eyes. You kept getting weaker. Took to your bed, tired and bitter with the injustice of your life surrendered. But in the moment of victory, I was scared and, oh God, I didn't want to kill you. You were my father, I just wanted you to love me. I didn't know what to do. I dug up the cat, searched through the remnants of the book, but there was no method of reversal. You were dying and I was helpless and ashamed. I cried, I racked my brains, and I'm embarrassed to admit it now. I even prayed. Didn't do any good, though. In desperation, I broke into the school and stole a jar of formaldehyde from the lab. My magic had linked your life force to the carcass of the cat. If I could stop it rotting, I might at least arrest your inexorable decline. So, John, I linked his... The only way he could help his father go away is digging up the cat and placing it on his mother's grave. Just as Gemma comes looking for John, he set fire to it and says to Emma, come and get warm, kid. You can keep me company and we'll say goodbye to Granddad together. Gruesome end to the story, but a bit hopeful as well. Mm-hmm. Should we start as we normally do by looking at the cover?
Yes.
So, what was your reaction to that cover, Erigail?
So, I really liked this cover. I thought it was like, if I'd remembered, I would have remembered that we would have done this cover artist before.
Yeah, I mean, it is very different from the image that he did in that issue of Marvel Fanfare.
It's quite similar in the sense that it's...
I think the brushwork's similar, but that...
opaque and a bit kind of, you know...
But I think the other one was more kind of a watercolour. It was more watery. Right. You could see through the colours. This looks more like an acrylic or an oil paint or something. Mm. And it's a weird cover. I mean... One of the things that was happening in the kind of late 80s, early 90s is more and more they were doing comics suggested for mature readers, as it says up there, suggested for mature readers. The idea is they're not for kids.
Mm.
You know, they're kind of special comics that are a bit more adult.
Mm.
And one of the things they had in common, these series, is quite often they had slightly abstract covers.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got to admit, when I picked this up, back in 1990, I thought that was meant to be an image of John Constantine.
Mm.
You know, I'd read comics with him in before. The blurriness, I thought, was meant to suggest maybe he was sleeping or dreaming because there's a star and a moon and a sun. I didn't notice that he had a missing arm, which obviously is a reference to his father being an amputee.
Yeah.
But I didn't notice that in the picture. I just thought, naked person, blurry face, maybe dreamlike, bit abstract. It didn't put me off.
No.
You know, by that point, I'd already read one or two of these kinds of books that were edited by Karen Berger, written by the British writers.
Mm-hmm.
And they tended to use these abstract covers.
Mm-hmm.
But you knew there was a level of quality in there, so it was worth trying one, even if you didn't know what it was about.
Yeah.
And obviously, one of the things that drew me in with that was the fact that, you know, it's got the names on the front. It's got the names of the writer and artist. So it's Jamie Delano, who I knew from having read previous Hellblazers, not all of them, but a couple. And Sean Phillips, I knew from his UK work. I knew his art in Crisis, which is a series I used to buy in... from Fleetway. It was a UK based comic, kind of an adult comic. Mm-hmm. And I love Sean Phillips' art and always did and always will, you know. We met him at, well, you didn't meet him actually, you weren't with me for that, but I met him at, you know, when we went to Portsmouth Comic Con.
Yeah.
He was there and I bought a graphic novel of him and he did a little sketch in the front and he just chatted to him for quite a while. He was just a really nice guy.
Okay.
And he spent ages on the sketch, lots of like, detail, and I wasn't expecting that. I thought I'd have to pay extra for the sketch. And he was like, no, it's all free. Just a really nice guy, but amazing art, and I loved it anyway. If we go back to the cover, I just wanted to mention a couple of other things. I wanted to mention the name Hellblazer. Now, you thought I said Hellraiser, didn't you?
I did initially, yeah.
Yeah, and I suspect that DC half wanted that confusion.
Okay. Yeah,
you know, at no point in a John Constantine story does somebody go, oh, look, it's the Hellblazer. He's not a superhero character.
Right.
And it does say John Constantine Hellblazer. Mm. It doesn't just say Hellblazer, but no. It's interesting that they did that, you know.
Mm.
I love that logo. We have to mention the logo was designed by artist Dave McKean, who did the covers for the first, I think about the first 25 issues, maybe 26, of Hellblazer. And then Kent Williams took over and did the covers up to issue 40. And he was a great designer as well as a great artist. But no, it is a good cover.
Mm.
And it's intriguing and it's moody. And But there's more to that cover after you read the story.
Mm.
And I think, you know, this was one of the kind of, sometimes we'll call, I'll probably talk about this throughout the thing, we kind of call it proto-vertigo. So there was this imprint at DC that was all the adult comics that was run by Karen Berger, who's the editor of this, and it was called Vertigo, and it only recently kind of wound up after being launched in 93. But Vertigo kind of existed before the imprint did. There was a group of comics that you knew were all fairly similar. They had this feel and people would buy them all. And, you know, this cover feels very much part of that. And one of the things that was quite traditional on those, even though sometimes they use very different art styles, is that you would get more out of it after you'd read it. You'd see things in there, you know, and I think that's true. You know, you see an image, you see the ghostliness, which I suppose you could read as a ghost or you could read it as someone sleeping. As I say, the moon and the star, you know, made me think it was a dreaming, someone dreaming. And obviously the colours are great. You know, they really do a good job in this period of using colour. You know, Kent Williams is great at that. But even, you know, simple things like the writing on the cover, it's white against black, and the logo is in like a pale green that reflects some of the greeny tones that's in the image. Beautiful, isn't it? In a way, beautiful and creepy.
Slightly off program.
Nothing's off program.
The advert for Dick Tracy.
Did you see when his film's coming out?
June the 15th, which is the day before your birthday.
And it's also the day of?
Our anniversary.
Our wedding anniversary. Not that 1990 was one of our wedding anniversaries. No. As June the 15th, 1990, I was still 15 and Irigo was still 14, and that would have been very inappropriate.
Absolutely. So, no, the other thing, more seriously, was that it's on black paper or printed all the way.
Yeah, I mean,
the whole page is printed as opposed to
part of the thing they could do. It's part of like the formatting. These were slightly more expensive than some comics, you know, than the basic newsstand one. And they had more things they could do printing wise, and they could print right to the edge, you know, and that was a relatively new thing in 1990. I think the first comics that were doing that probably started about 84, 85. So it's relatively new still. But what it does, as you say, the fact that they go right to the edge with the black really gives you a feeling of, I want to say claustrophobia, but I don't know if that's right. What kind
of, you know that it's not, so you know, Little Bo Peep, sort of. Like
yeah, it definitely sets a tone. It
sets a tone. The other thing, which I think occurred to me a bit later on, was that the, it's, possibly a little bit photojournalistic, I kind of think, maybe.
Yeah, I would say that's true. Sean Phillips is renowned for using models, for looking at photographs, for getting reference. He will, quite often in comics actually, less so in this one than some of them, but quite often you will see like a face that is clearly Sean Phillips himself.
Right, right.
He would use his own face and he would...
Yeah. You don't really see the father very much, but...
No, he's kind of a background character in this story. So, he's been more prominent in earlier stories.
So you get the kind of... The bright colours, the... Yeah. I think it's just... It's difficult to describe.
I mean, I know that you came in. Irigo goes off to read it separately while I was doing something else. Well, I was prepping dinner because we're a very glamorous household, which is slowly bubbling away on the stove, a nice curry.
I think that was a fly.
Oh, dear. And Irigel went and read it in the other room. And when he came in, he's like, oh, it's really good.
Yeah.
You know, that was your first reaction, I think, was that it was really good and really different to what we covered before.
Yes.
And what I think I got out of it at the time as, I mean, I was a kid, I was 15, but maybe I was a mature reader, maybe I wasn't. But there was kind of an expansion to what a comic could be. Didn't have to be superheroes. The art style didn't have to be kind of super heroic. Like, it could have feelings of naturalism, but also, you know, some very extreme stuff as well. It's, you know, it really did have a different flavour, really worked differently. Shall we, I mean, let's kind of step back.
Okay.
Let's step back rather than trying to cover the whole thing at once.
What did
you think of the characters? Which characters did you notice? Which characters did you like? How did you...
I think a lot of the things that we had done previously, they had less of a sense of place.
Well, that's less about the characters. I did ask you about the characters. Yeah, so no. I was going to ask you about Liverpool later.
Okay. Characters. Yeah. So I think they're all...
Let's say the comic is called John Constantine Hellblazer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that comic's about John Constantine?
Eventually, I was...
I would say it's equally about Gemma.
I thought it was about the girl more to start off with.
Mm.
But you sure that fly's okay? Probably not.
Well, dinner.
No, that's the fly.
Oh, okay.
I think.
Are we just going to let that... You can talk about that while I'm going and checking dinner.
Okay.
It's fine, it's just dead. Oh, is
it? Okay.
Dinner's coming on nicely, though.
Okay. So the photojournalism I thought was very interesting. The way that you're not quite sure what's happening is always interesting.
He definitely, when it's written there, they definitely throw you into it.
Yeah.
No one's holding your hand. You're set up in this story. It's a teenage girl in her bedroom and suddenly there's a ghost of her granddad there who's trying to get in bed with her.
Which I thought was going to be a lot more adult than...
Yeah, I mean, the fear is exactly the thing that her parents think.
Yeah.
You know, and the look on his face as he's trying to get into the bed, and the idea that he just wants to be warm, and he just wants...
So do you think that's because he's a ghost? That he wants
it's because he's dead, he's cold, he's naked. Yeah. You know, he's been murdered, so he's been... Yes.
So we don't know that at this point he's been murdered.
You don't, because I'd not read the previous story. I probably should have said my Hellblazer kind of experience. I bought an issue like about 10 issues before or something. And then in between that and buying this one, I'd picked up some UK reprints,
mm-hmm.
Which reprinted the stories in black and white. And then, so I knew a bit about what the character was about, and I'd seen like guest appearances elsewhere, but I didn't know this story. Whereas somebody who was reading the book on a regular basis, the previous issue is, there's like a 3 or 4 part story about the family man who's a serial killer. And John gets involved with him and actually helps him by accident because of various reasons. You know, one of John's friends is helping this guy, not knowing he's a serial killer. His friend dies and John takes over and helps him.
Okay.
And then he realises that he's helped a serial killer to get away with killing someone. So he starts hunting him down, but the serial killer realises and goes after him and therefore kills his father. So somebody who's read it, and I've read them now, probably only a couple of years ago, but would have known it. So a regular reader of Hellblazer would have opened this and instantly known, John's father, he's been murdered. Gemma, they'd know because she'd in previous stories. Well, she was younger.
So what do we think the colour scheme is about?
The colour scheme's very interesting on this comic.
No.
I love the colours on this comic. I love the fact that it's so bold. It's almost wrong. You know, there's lots of really bright oranges. Lots of reddy tones. The blue there is really bright on the page you're looking at. Really yellow. Strong. And I loved it. And actually, it is mentioned in the letter column a couple of issues later. This was the first issue of me buying this regularly. That something went wrong at the printers and this is printed wrong.
Ah.
So this whole issue, the colours went wrong. Now, DC, we talked before about how they were kind of moving from hand separations to computer separations and computers were coming in. So this is a comic that's coloured by somebody using the kind of hand colouring system and then somebody would translate that. They would like cut out things to create the colours on the comic.
Right.
And because the computers were coming in and it was a different person, apparently something went wrong. And all the colours were made more vibrant than they were intended to be.
Okay.
But it really works and it adds atmosphere and it's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, I like it much more than what Tom Suico sometimes did in this series, which was because he was trying for kind of realism and it was England in the 80s and the stories were quite dark. You'd have a lot of like greys and very dark blues and browns and it would all be kind of sludgy and dark. And actually here you've got a great big acid yellow and an acid green and an orange in amongst the greys.
And a James poster.
Yeah, James poster. There's also a Happy Mondays one there.
Oh, is that Happy Mondays?
Yeah, on the side. Can you see it? It's Happy Mondays. So, you know, there is a realism there. I think characters, I want to talk a bit about the characters.
Okay.
Because Gemma's there.
Yeah.
And, I mean, she is what her uncle says. You know, he says she's strong. She's, you know, she's a teenage girl.
Okay.
But she's completely able to cope. She's coping better than her parents.
Mm.
Even though she's going through this horrific thing, she's seeing this monstrous version.
She's a teenage girl, is she?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, because I thought sometimes...
There's certain elements where she looks a bit older.
Yeah, I think that...
I mean, the outfit at the funeral, obviously, it's more of a grown-up outfit. So yeah, that makes you look older. People dress...
Shoulder pads.
Yeah, shoulder pads, because it's 1990. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she comes across quite old. Now, she'd appeared in previous Hellblazer stories.
Okay.
And there'd been a story previously, and it actually gets referenced. It's not like before. It's not like with the Hanged Man. And there'd been a story where... she'd almost been seduced, this man who was going to be her boyfriend, and it was actually a demon or something. I don't quite remember the details.
Mm.
But, you know, she was going to be the bride of the demon and, you know, this thing happening before. And what's quite interesting about that as well is, you know, I said she was older than she had been when she'd been seen previously.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things they did with Hellblazer, with this series, is it ran in real time initially.
Okay.
So, you know, John gets a year older every year because it was a different type of comic. It wasn't like Superman. It wasn't like, you know, Superman is eternally the same age. Batman is always the same age, pretty much. And the idea was it was meant to move in real time. So this comic set in 1990, you know, 31 issues before when it launched, it was nearly 3 years earlier, 3 years earlier.
Mm.
It was set 3 years earlier, you know, and it was meant to be doing it. And they actually did that for quite a long time, a surprisingly long time.
Mm.
Because actually, you know, the series lasted, and I don't think they expected this, it lasted over 20 years. So they had to keep aging him. And in the end, DC kind of made him younger again. But she
so on
was.
Page five.
Yeah.
Do you think that he used a real photo?
Yeah. I think he's used photos in places.
Of sort of like of a building. And then
they used to do. It was a thing. You see it quite often in comics, actually, where they kind of get a high contrast photo. Because you have to get the black and white elements. So it was almost like a rudimentary scan rather than an actual photograph. Mm.
Yeah, it looks like a photocopy.
Yeah. And they would really do that. So, yeah, that's it. You talked a bit before about sense of place.
Yes.
It's set in Liverpool. I mean, obviously, as you noticed, Damien didn't do a Liverpudlian accent because I can't. Yeah. But it is set in Liverpool and there's a real feeling of Liverpool. And I think it's a strength. Some of it is the artist, Sean Phillips, but actually a lot of it, I think, is Jamie Delano. He is, I talked in his kind of introduction, talking about who he was.
Mm.
I said he came from Northampton and he was involved in the art scene there. And it was a scene that involved people like Alan Moore and other people. Mm. And it was kind of a mix of like musicians and artists and writers working together.
Mm-hmm.
But the really big thing about that scene is it was working class.
Mm.
And Jamie Delano is a working class writer, which maybe for the American market makes less of a difference. But when you're talking about a British story, your class makes a huge difference. And I think he really is good at getting kind of real life in the kind of working class sense, you know, that you go, you've got the funeral. And the way funerals are, they may not be like huge things because there's not the money to like fly people in from all around the world or, you know,
the
get people down.
Very,
The Undertaker, the guy, it's very much like the working slob.
Yeah.
You know, he's eating his sandwiches while the man's in, like, while the body's in the oven.
Yeah.
You know, at the crematorium, he's kind of jolly in a very working class, particular kind of middle-aged man.
He looks Northern, if...
I don't know if he looks Norman. He just looks... I think he's got that real kind of working man look.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think my dad had friends like that.
He looks like Fred Dibner. Anybody.
Do you know what? He really does look like Fred Dibner. I thought it might be a caricature. Sean Phillips, as I said, is very good at likenesses.
Yeah.
And uses photographs. So he really does look like Fred Dibner. And I knew I recognised him and I didn't place it.
You're going to have...
American listeners are going to really struggle with Fred Dibner. Look him up. It's easier than us trying to explain who he is.
Spell it.
D-I-B-N-A-H. Yeah, he does really look like it. And the whole thing where he's got, like, his magazine and he's got his sandwich. He's got, like, he's got, like, a piece of what looks like a bit of kitchen roll on his lap with his sandwiches on that, where they were obviously wrapped in that, and he's unwrapped them. And, you know, that kind of ghoulish humour that you get, and John comments on it. You've got the two things going on at once. You've got the funeral happening at the same time as, you know, seeing behind the scenes, and you get the really gruesome idea of, like, the burnt ghost following her. It's just hideous, isn't it? But also amazingly. Yeah, he changes the colour of the backgrounds as you go through. Yeah, it's something you can do, but because you can go to the edge, it gives you the opportunity to do things. And, you know, one of the things that's quite noticeable is when they're trapped, they're in the small kitchen. It's very uniform page layouts. They're in squares, they're in boxes, they're all the same size for the conversation between Cheryl and John. You know, and what I find quite interesting here, and again, this is a working class writer from the 80s and 90s, the fact that, you know, John is taking the piss out of Cheryl's situation.
Yeah.
He's taking the piss out of her husband, you know, and there's a running joke, I don't know if that's the right word, but, like, about how all he does is he screws caps on toothpaste, and, you know, he takes the piss out of him for that, but he also doesn't blame him for that. You know, he blames that on the destruction of the kind of the economy of the North by the Tories, you know, and that's a key part of it. It's very political as well as personal. You know, and therefore, you know, the father is actually, who's almost missing in the story, is he's depressed. And he's depressed because his life's been changed. You know, and the woman's having to hold it together. There's a real, there's kind of realism mixed in with the really weird stuff. Do you know what I mean? I think he does that very well. So you're skipping on here. So you're looking at the bit where they go out for a walk.
Yeah.
And there, suddenly, it's much more obvious that she's a teenager.
Yes.
You know, she's in her hoodie. She's, you know, she's not dressed up like a grown-up, like a teenager is when they go to a funeral. You have to dress up like a grown-up, even though you're not a grown-up. And again, you know, I love the way that where the colours went wrong.
Yeah.
Everything's orange. It's blood red. It's orange. It's really evocative of the, and what it does, that page you're looking at there now, I'll put a picture of this in there. There's a page of him trying to talk to his father, and opposite is an advert for Who's Who in the DC universe.
Yes.
And it's like the worlds apart being next to each other, because the colours, the style of art going to the edge really stands out against typical, you know, a picture that's got Superman in it. Anything else? I mean, I was trying to talk about characters.
He's got green hair.
He has, briefly.
Briefly.
So we talked a bit about Gemma. She's quite a realistic ish teenager.
Yeah, I would say so.
And I think the element of the thing that feels very true to me, and I mean, Gemma is only slightly younger than me, really, in the story. What feels very realistic is that idea of the kid having to keep it together while the parents are falling apart. You know, and I don't know if that's something I experience, but, you know, kids are just, oh, I'm a kid, I have to be happy and not upset my parents because they've got a lot going on. You know, that feels very realistic. John, what do you think we get of John's character in this? Because he's the I mean, he's the title character. He's meant to be the hero.
Yeah, I wouldn't have necessarily seen him as... I was a bit confused at one point where...
He's kind of set up as a hero, isn't he? Because there's that whole thing with Uncle John's going to come, he'll sort it, he'll be here, he'll fix everything.
I wasn't quite sure.
But then when he comes, he doesn't want to get involved.
Yeah.
Then you've got that flashback to him doing something really gruesome. You know, he hated his father. He doesn't want to go to his father's funeral as such. He doesn't want to be in the room with the praising.
Mm.
And then you've got the flashback to him being a teenager. And, you know, he kills a cat.
Yes.
Which, you know, I think particularly from like a British point of view is like killing animals is like, it's the ultimate crime.
Mm.
Killing a defenseless animal for no reason. And yet, you know, and cursing his own father, and yet he's kind of the hero. How did you react to that?
I think I was... What did I... I thought, well, that's slightly extreme.
I mean, it is slightly extreme, and it's... comic books are extreme, but... And a lot of fiction is, you know... If you did something that was actually what really happens in life, you would come up with quite dull stuff a lot of the time.
Yes.
But one of the key things to Constantine is that he's not necessarily a good person all the time.
Mm.
He, you know, he's set up in the stories as in balance, he's trying to save the world.
Mm.
But he does individual things that are beyond the pale.
Mm.
And he's a very complex character, and obviously that in some ways that's very 80s, you know, the anti-hero, you know, you've got your Rambos who are just killing everyone who comes along, you've got your, you know, that kind of thing's out there, it's in the ether, you know. But then at a very personal level, you know, he's, you see him with the teenage girl and he's a very good uncle, you know. Yes. He's, yes, listening, right. He's believing her where other people won't.
Yes.
You know, other people are, oh, something else must have happened that I don't understand. Mm, or whereas he's just like, yeah, she wouldn't lie to me, so it's right, you know. He's a very complex character. One of the interesting things, obviously this is part of a storyline, and I said there'd just been the thing with, you know, his father was murdered to get at him.
Right.
But he
didn't
get on with his father.
Yes.
You also get the mention of his mother dying in childbirth.
Yes.
And this is part of a bigger storyline. So what Jamie Delano tended to do was he wouldn't do like a 10-part story and it's like part one, part two, part three, you know, and it was all one story, but he would have like underlying plot lines, like as for B plots really, continuing on. And ultimately kind of issue, I would say about issue 20 to issue 40 is one story about where John came from.
Right.
So it's about explaining how you end up with an adult, with a grown-up person who can be that ruthless and has got the knowledge to defeat, like, demons and ghosts and, you know, foul things, but is also maybe trying to be good, but there's stuff. So this is part of a story, and the next story in it actually is more stories of his childhood.
Okay.
And finding out more about his childhood, and then eventually the point where Jamie Delano leaves, which is issue 40, does a story about his mother and, you know, quite how he related to that and how he, you know, kind of the idea, the magical curse of killing your mother in your birth.
Yeah.
And how that would have a, because it's meant to be a magical story, it's meant to be supernatural, how that almost puts a mark on you.
Yeah.
Because, you know, somebody was killed for you to have a life, and that has an effect. And, you know, that kind of, maybe not stain, I mean, that sounds really awful, but, you know, and also, you know, everything's coming to a head here. Jamie Delano stuff, it's very political.
Right.
He's coming out of this working class artistic movement from the 80s in the UK, in Northampton, which was a place that was really affected by industrial decline under Thatcher. And this, you know, a key part of the story, I think, for him and what he was trying to get across is what is done to you affects you.
Yeah.
And, you know, if someone is a criminal, there's a reason for it. If someone is a bad person, there's a reason for it. And I think there's a real, you know, that kind of is it's a thread throughout. And I think it very much is, the whole thing is a reaction to the Thatcherite idea.
The sins of your fathers and that.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, you know, within the story as well, what I think Jamie Delano does very well in this story is within the story, he even goes as far as to have John saying, oh, you know, I was the liberal, you know, I was the new person with the new ideas and you were the traditional working class man and we couldn't get on. You know, he goes that blatant on it so that he's acknowledging that it's really obvious what he's doing.
Yes, yes.
But at the same time, and actually sometimes by using that humour, it lets you be more subtle underneath.
Yes.
You know, and I think...
And that's always, I mean, that's on the psychological level, that's always what you need to do to separate yourself from your parents.
Yeah. Do you know what? I think as well, that kind of separation, that kind of the reality and the irreality going on, you know, or... the kind of dichotomy between traditional working class, modern working class, and it's different. You know, a working class man used to have, part of the story is there, the working class man had pride and he was a worker and he was strong.
Yeah.
And now the working class man, if he's lucky, he's screwing caps on in the factory. It's more...
But to be fair, they always were.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing was always going on. But, you know, the idea of the working class being more of an underclass was something that was coming through in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it. And I think, you know, to get that dichotomy as well, he treats, like, the horror coming in as being the same as the kind of change of attitudes and change of the world.
So do you think there are links with films like... Day of the Dead and...
Oh, definitely. You know, any John horror Carpenter. That comes out of the 80s...
John Carpenter, I think.
Yeah, yeah, comes out of those kind of... I know what you mean, like the... John Carpenter was... he's the one with the zombies, isn't he? I'm not as good on films as I am on comics. But it's in the ether, the idea that it is... It's the Reagan-Thatcher era that's the real villain and that the horror that's happening is because of the era.
Yeah.
And the monsters might be something else. And that's something actually Alan Moore, who created the character, had done with Constantine previously. Mm. You know, when he first appeared in Swamp Thing, he was kind of guiding Swamp Thing round a trip of America. It's called American Gothic, the storyline.
Oh, okay.
And he's meeting all the traditional monsters, but in, like, modern forms.
Mm.
So, you know, the variation of the werewolf is... a woman who's downtrodden who turns into a werewolf during her period. And it's about gender politics. The version of a vampire is about kids who are looked down upon by their parents and, you know, kind of a different class thing.
Mm.
You know, for like zombies, it does a racism thing where kind of like the slaves are coming back to get, you know, to try and revenge what had been done to them. So he did that, and obviously he was a mentor to Jamie Delano, but that was part of what was there. But yeah, I just think it's really well written. I think as well, we probably haven't talked that much about the art.
No.
Other than to say it's really good.
Okay.
Particular thing I like about the art in this one that I think he does very well is using different styles for different things. So the ghost of the granddad has a very different look to everything else.
Yes.
He's kind of more extreme. I mean, it's got an element, you were talking the other day about it, when we saw Egan Schiele's work.
Yes, okay, yeah.
It's got an element of that really extreme skinniness and that nudity and, you know, doing that, I think...
I thought Gollum.
Yeah, Gollum would be one as well. I mean, obviously the film that we react to, but it's a character that exists before.
What I also thought was... You may not have, you may never have seen this. The cartoon of Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah, I've not seen the cartoon.
Where they've got kind of, where again, like in this, they use kind of photo, where they put filters on things to make things funny colours and that sort of thing. And a lot of, so when the famous scene where Frodo is hiding from the orcs.
Oh, yeah, and he's there, but they can't see him because,
So I think there was quite a lot of colour. I think there was probably quite a lot of influence of horror from things like that, maybe.
I mean, definitely, yeah, I think that's there. I think another thing I like is I like the fact that the art becomes more cartoony for the flashback.
Right. Okay.
So when someone's recalling, you know, when he's talking about what he did in the late 60s and he's the hippie, he very much looks like a drawing of a hippie by a kid. It's got this kind of a different texture rather than the realism of the present. And it's, you know, kind of, it's a very clever way of moving from one thing to another.
Yeah.
You know, and Sean Phillips is great at that. He always has been. He's an amazing artist. He was drawing comics at 15 because he's hugely talented and they were pretty good comics, but he just got better and better. This is 10 years in, you know, we're now talking 40 years into his career. Just gets better and better. So overall, I think we've got a good comic, do we say? Should I love this comic? What's the answer?
I think you should. I would be interested in reading the other episodes. And also, before we wrap up, Constantine the film.
Yeah, I mean, I've not seen it.
Nor have I.
My understanding is they changed it a lot. I mean, they said it in America.
Yes.
Which instantly changes it a lot.
Of course.
And removed it from England.
They must have been quite big, so this was a big deal for it.
It was a very successful. I mean, it went for 20 years.
How God did it?
Which, you know, comics don't often do that, and particularly comics that launched in the mid to late 80s.
Okay.
You know, the stuff that runs for 80 years is the, sorry, for 20 years is the stuff that runs for 80 years.
So was
he? It's the stuff that never stops. Yeah, yeah, he was a British character. Oh, okay. So he first appeared in American Stories, but he was a British guy. Okay. And actually, I meant to say this. Oh, God, what an idiot. The origin of John Constantine. Key thing for us to cover is how he came about. And literally, the character came about because the artists of Swamp Thing, who were two British guys, mm-hmm. no, lying, two American guys, Steve Bissett and John Totterbun, they wanted to draw a character who looked like Sting. They thought Sting was really cool. They wanted to draw Sting. So at one point in one of the issues of Swamp Thing, there's a character in the background that looks like Sting. And I mean, down to having the stripy top on.
Yeah.
And then they're just like, we want to draw this character more.
Mm.
And that combining with Alan Moore, he's writing Swamp Thing. He's going to do this story where Swamp Thing goes around America and finds out about things. So he needs some way of guiding him. So he uses this character to guide him. He uses this character that... So he kind of created him, Alan Moore and the artist did. But they didn't, because it was just they want to draw Sting. He just kind of came about. So he's quite interesting. And actually, Alan Moore tells a story. And again, it's an Alan Moore story. We have to think about that. Yeah. But he tells a story about actually meeting John Constantine.
Oh, okay.
Now, being in a cafe, it was a cafe in London somewhere, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And John Constantine literally just walking by. And it is, and him feeling, yeah, that is the actual character. I didn't create this. Mm. And then other stuff was put on it. So within that, he's going round and there'd been references within the Alan Moore stories to him being a Liverpudlian. Somebody referred to him as a jumped-up street thug or something at one point. There'd also been references to a big thing that had gone wrong in the past, which was Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
So Newcastle, something had happened in Newcastle. And then Jamie Delano takes over and he's got to come up with what's his story, why is he in London now, and he was in Liverpool and he moved around the world and he kind of knows about magic, but he's not like a proper wizard or anything. He's kind of peripheral, and, you know, and he then explains it all. But the character exists just because somebody wanted to draw Sting.
No one, that's interesting, but no one has an accent in this. Like,
no, they don't. I mean, one of the, I would personally say is good things about this is they're not doing phonetic accents.
Right.
People do talk in slang terms that would be appropriate to them.
Okay.
And they use different slang terms in the British and the American.
They don't have, but they don't have,
you know, I can't do a Liverpudlian accent or, you know, calm down. You know, they're not misspelling things in order to reflect a dialogue.
Mm.
They're not doing that. And actually, I prefer that because you can just... I think the problem with doing that is it adds a level of artificiality.
Yeah, maybe.
And I think actually that is a real feature of the X-Men, weirdly. It's something Chris Claremont, the writer on the X-Men, did a lot.
Mm.
And that was the biggest thing in the 80s. And obviously, people like Jamie Delano are coming in and they're going, I'm doing something different. I'm swerving where he'd go straight on. And I think, you know, if you want to do something more grown up, the idea would be to not do what they're doing.
Mm.
You know, that there's other ways of getting across dialect differences or accent differences. You know, someone can mention an accent. Someone can, you know, yeah, it's, you know, that kind of thing's quite interesting.
But, and unless it's done well, sort of like, I think it's very difficult.
But I think the Englishness of John Constantine is key.
It's a bit like, I wouldn't say Thomas Mann, or Thomas Hardy or someone like that. Mm. It's... so you really have to concentrate when you're reading.
Yeah.
When you're reading dialect, and it can take you away from...
It can take you out of it, or it can bring you in. And it's got different advantages and disadvantages, dialect. Mm. And it is used sometimes, and Jamie Delano does use it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, part of what I feel he's doing, and this is me speaking, not him.
Mm.
It's not something I've read, is that he wants to say... The working classes are vital, they're important,
yes.
We're real people. And because of that, I think to really emphasise working class accents to me feels like something a middle class person would do. And actually there are points where there are very, very posh people in it, and that's when they're given an accent.
Yeah.
So you're highlighting the thing that is actually in real life unusual, and the normal thing isn't.
Yes.
But anyway, we've gone off in some really weird things.
Yes.
So you're saying you would like to watch the film. It would be interesting to watch it.
The only reason I would like to watch it is because...
Because you have a huge crush on Keanu Reeves, yes.
I've got a huge crush on Keanu Reeves, mid to late noughties. But yeah. I would have said
your Keanu Reeves was more 80s.
I don't think it's a very good film.
No, my understanding is it's not great. I have heard people say it's a better film if you've not read the comics.
Okay.
Because if you've read the comics, you want the comics.
Yeah, yeah.
And the comics are exceptionally good numerous times. Now, it's a series because of the nature of it, because it's a relatively ordinary person. They change a lot from writer to writer, more so than other things. You know, Superman changes when you change the writer. But Superman, he's a man who can fly and punch through mountains.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not real, it's not ordinary, it's not normal. Whereas the change of writers has a bigger influence, but he had a history of the writers who wrote Hellblazer. Were all very good and all did very different things, but did amazing things. You know, Jamie Delano is doing this run, which is amazing. It finishes at issue 40. The end is just like blowing your mind, and it goes off in Jamie Delano direction. And then a writer takes over called Garth Ennis, who's a guy from Northern Ireland, and he's got a different attitude. He's bringing in more humour. Yes. He deals with Ireland more. He deals with like more visceral horror in some ways than Jamie Delano. It's less kind of political horror, you know. And then, you know, Paul Jenkins comes in and he does something different, maybe a bit more new agey and sometimes, but, you know, again, really harsh. And then, you know, so many writers have done great runs with the character. And at the moment, actually, in DC, they are publishing a Hellblazer comic, which is mentioned as being the best thing that DC are doing. And sadly, it's being cancelled.
Yes.
Because it's not selling well enough, which just seems like an absolute shame. But that's by a writer called Cy Spurrier, working with various different artists. Mm. But the art looks amazing. And obviously, a character like this, if you're talking about the series being like a view on England or the UK, I mean, at the moment, you know, and the horror within our lives at times, you can imagine how vital that is now, you know. So, you know, a great character, a great story we've reviewed. We definitely agreed we should love this comic.
Yes.
So that's it for this episode. I think next time, I'm tempted to go for a humour comic next time.
Yes.
Let's go in a completely different direction, but I think we've done really well today. I think this is a great comic. I think it's beautifully drawn, it's well written, it's got a great cover, and I like the colour that had gone wrong. I thought it looked better than the normal colour for that comic. Anyway, on that note, should we say goodbye?
Here we go. I think we probably should.
Okay, goodbye everyone. Thank you very much for joining us. See you next month.
Thank you for listening.
Bye. La 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 la. That's me recording myself drinking.